It was said more than once over deep cups in the mead houses of Delane that Peter had gotten the best of both worlds, his mother's brains and his father's love of the common folk. There was apparently no meanness in Peter. He never went through a period when he pulled the wings off flies or singed dogs' tails to see them run. In fact, he intervened in the matter of a horse which was to be destroyed by Yosef, the king's head groom, and it was when this tail made its way to Flag that the magician began to fear the king's oldest son, and to think perhaps he did not have as long to put the boy out of the way as he had once thought. For in the affair of the horse with the broken leg, Peter had displayed courage and a depth of resolve which Flag did not like at all. XIV. Peter was passing through the stable yard when he saw a horse tethered to the hitching rail just outside the main barn. The horse was holding one of its rear legs off the ground. As Peter watched, Yosef spat on his hands and picked up a heavy maul. What he meant to do was obvious. Peter was both frightened and appalled. He rushed over. "Who told you to kill this horse?" he asked. Yosef, a hardy and robust 60, was a palace fixture. He was not apt to brook the interference of a snot-nosed brat easily, prince or no. He fixed Peter with a thunderous, heavy look that was meant to wilt the boy. Peter, then just 9, reddened, but did not wilt. He seemed to see a look in the horse's mild brown eyes which said, "You're my only hope, whoever you are. Do what you can, please."
"My father, and his father before him, and his father before him," Yosef said, seeing now that he was going to have to say something, like it or not. "That's who told me to kill it. A horse with a broken leg is no good to any living thing, least of all to itself."
He raised the maul a little.
"You see, this hammer is a murder weapon, but when you're older, you'll see it for what it really is in cases such as these, a mercy. Now stand back so you don't get splashed."
He raised the maul in both hands. "Put it down," Peter said. Yosef was thunderstruck. He had never been interfered with in such a way.
"Here, here! What are you a-saying?"
"You heard me. I said, put that hammer down." As he said these words, Peter's voice deepened. Yosef suddenly realized, really, really realized, that it was the future king standing here in this dusty stable yard commanding him. If Peter had actually said as much, if he had stood there in the dust, squeaking,
"Put that down, put it down, I said. I'm going to be king someday, king, do you hear? So you put that down."
Yosef would have laughed contemptuously, spat, and ended the broken-legged horse's life with one hard swing of his deeply muscled arms. But Peter did not have to say any such thing. The command was clear in his voice and eyes.
"Your father shall hear of this, my princeling,"
Yosef said. "And when he hears it from you, it will be for the second time," Peter replied. "I will let you go about your work with no further complaint, Lord High Groom, if I may put a single question to you which you answer yes."
"Ask your question," Yosef said.
He was impressed with the boy, almost against his will. When he had told Yosef that he, Peter, would tell his father of the incident first, Yosef believed he meant what he said. The simple truth shone in the lad's eyes. Also, he had never been called Lord High Groom before, and he rather liked it. "Has the horse doctor seen this animal?" Peter asked. Yosef was thunderstruck.
"That is your question, that?"
"Yes."
"Dear creeping gods, no!" he cried,
and seeing Peter flinch, he lowered his voice, squatted before the boy, and attempted to explain.
"A horse with a broken leg is a goner, your highness. Always a goner. Leg never mends right. There's apt to be blood poisoning. Terrible pain for the horse. Terrible pain. In the end, its poor heart is apt to burst, or it takes a brain fever and goes mad. Now do you understand what I meant when I said this hammer was mercy rather than murder?"
Peter thought long and gravely with his head down. Yosef was silent, squatting before him in an almost unconscious posture of deference, allowing him the full courtesy of time. Peter raised his head and asked, "You say everyone says this?"
"Everyone, your highness. Why, my father—"
"Then we'll see if the horse doctor says it, too.
Oh, pah! The groom bellowed, and threw the hammer all the way across the courtyard. It sailed into a pig pen and struck head down in the mud. The pigs grunted and squealed and cursed him in their piggy Latin. Joseph, like Flag, was not used to being balked and took no notice of them. He got up and stalked away. Peter watched him, troubled, sure that he must be in the wrong and knowing he was apt to face a severe whipping for this little piece of work. Then, halfway across the yard, the head groom turned, and a reluctant, grim little smile hit across his face like a single sunray on a gray morning.
"Go get your horse, doctor," he said. "Get him yourself, son. You'll find him in his animal surgery at the far end of Third Eastern Alley, I reckon. I'll give you 20 minutes. If you're not back with him by then, I'm putting my maul into yon horse's brains, prince or no prince."
"Yes, Lord Head Groom," Peter yelled. "Thank you."
He raced away. When he returned with the young horse doctor, puffing and out of breath, Peter was sure that the horse must be dead. The son told him 3 times 20 minutes had passed, but Joseph, curious, had waited. Horse doctoring and veterinary medicine were then very new things in Delane, and this young man was only the third or fourth who had practiced the trade, so Joseph's look of sour distrust was far from surprising. Nor had the horse doctor been happy to be dragged away from his surgery by the sweating, wide-eyed prince, but he became less irritated now that he had a patient. He knelt before the horse and felt the broken leg gently with his hands, humming through his nose as he did so. The horse shifted once as something he did pained her.
"Be steady, Nag," the horse doctor said calmly. "Be oh so steady."
The horse quieted. Peter watched all this in an agony of suspense. Joseph watched with his maul leaning nearby and his arms folded across his chest. His opinion of the horse doctor had gone up a little. The fellow was young, but his hands moved with gentle knowledge. At last the horse doctor nodded and stood up, dusting stable-yard grime from his hands.
"Well?"
Peter asked anxiously. "Kill her," the horse doctor said briskly to Joseph, ignoring Peter altogether. Joseph picked up his maul at once, for he had expected no other conclusion to the affair. But he found no satisfaction in being proved correct. The stricken look on the young boy's face went straight to his heart.
"Wait!"
Peter cried. And although his small face was full of distress, that deepness was in his voice again, making him sound much, much older than his years. The horse doctor looked at him, startled.
"You mean she'll die of blood poisoning?" Peter asked.
"What?" the horse doctor asked, eyeing Peter with a new care.
"She'll die of blood poisoning if she's allowed to live, or her heart will burst, or she will run mad?"
The horse doctor was clearly puzzled.
"What are you talking about? Blood poisoning? There is no blood poisoning here. The break is healing quite cleanly, in fact."
He looked at Joseph with some disdain. "I have heard such stories as these before. There is no truth in them."
"If you think not, you have much to learn, my young friend," Joseph said.
Peter ignored this. It was now his turn to be bewildered. He asked the young horse doctor, "Why do you tell the head groom to kill a horse which may heal?" "Your Highness," the horse doctor said briskly, "this horse would need to be poulticed every day and every night for a month or more to keep any infection from settling in. The effort might be made, but to what end? The horse would always limp. A horse that limps can't work. A horse that limps can't run for idlers to bet on. A horse that limps can only eat and eat and never earn its provender. Therefore, it should be killed." He smiled, satisfied. He had proved his case. Then, as Joseph started forward with his hammer again, Peter said, "I'll put on the poultices. If a day should come when I can't, then Ben Stodd will. And she'll be good because she'll be my horse, and I'll ride her even if she limps so badly she makes me seasick." Joseph burst out laughing and clapped the boy on his back so hard his teeth rattled.
"Your heart is kind as well as brave, my boy, but lads promise quick and regret at leisure. You'd not be true to it, I reckon."
Peter looked at him calmly.
"I mean what I say."
Joseph stopped laughing all at once. He looked at Peter closely and saw that the boy did indeed mean it, or at least thought he did. There was no doubt in his face.
"Well, I can't tarry here all day," the horse doctor said, adopting his former brisk and self-important manner.
I've given you my diagnosis. My bill will be presented to the Treasury in due course. Perhaps you'll pay it out of your allowance, Highness. In any case, what you decide to do is not my business. Good day.
Peter and the head groom watched him walk out of the stable yard, trailing a long afternoon shadow at his heels.
He's full of dung, Joseph said when the horse doctor was out of the gate,
beyond earshot and thus unable to contradict his words.
Mark me, Your Highness, and save yourself a lot of grief. There never was a horse what busted a leg and didn't get blood poisoning. It's God's way.
I want to talk to my father about this, Peter said.
And so I think you must,
Joseph said heavily. But as Peter trudged away, he smiled. He thought the boy had done right well for himself. His father would be honor-bound to see the boy was whipped for interfering with his elders, but the head groom knew that Roland set a great store by both of his sons in his old age, Peter perhaps a bit more than Thomas, and he believed that the boy would get his horse. Of course, he would also get a heartbreak when the horse died, but, as the horse doctor had quite rightly said, that was not his business. He knew about the training of horses. The training of princes was best left in other hands. Peter was whipped for interfering in the head groom's affairs, and although it was no solace to his stinging bottom, Peter's mind understood that his father had afforded him great honor by administering the whipping himself instead of handing Peter over to an underling who might have tried to curry favor by making it easy on the boy. Peter could not sleep on his back for 3 days and was not able to eat sitting down for nearly a week. But the head groom was also right about the horse. Roland allowed Peter to keep her.
It won't take up your time for long, Peter, Roland advised him. If Joseph says it will die, it will die.
Roland's face was a bit pale and his old hands were trembling. The beating had pained him more than it had pained Peter, who really was his favorite, although Roland foolishly fancied no one knew this but himself.
I don't know, Peter said. I thought that horse-doctoring fellow knew what he was talking about.
It turned out that the horse-doctoring fellow had. The horse did not take blood poisoning, and it did not die, and in the end its limp was so slight that even Joseph was forced to admit it was hardly noticeable.
At least when she's fresh, he amended.
Peter was more than just faithful about putting on the poultices. He was nearly religious. He changed old for new 3 times a day and did it a 4th time before he went to bed. Ben Stad did stand in for Peter from time to time, but those times were few. Peter named the horse Peony, and they were great friends ever after. Flagg had most assuredly been right about one thing on the day he advised Roland against letting Peter play with the dollhouse. Servants were everywhere. They see everything, and their tongues wag. Several servants had witnessed the scene in the stable yard, but if every servant who later claimed to have been there really had been, there would have been a mob of them crowded around the edges of the stable yard that hot summer day. That had, of course, not been the case, but the fact that so many of them found the event worth lying about was a sign that Peter was regarded as an interesting figure indeed. They talked about it so much that it became something of a 9 days wonder in Delane. Joseph also talked. So, for that matter, did the young horse doctor. Everything that they said spoke well for the young prince. Joseph's word in particular carried much weight because he was greatly respected. He began to call Peter the young king, something he had never done before.
"I believe God spared the nag because the young king stood up for her so brave-like," he said. "And he worked at them poultices like a slave. Brave he is. He's got the heart of a dragon. He'll make a king some day, all right. Aye, you should have heard his voice when he told me to hold them all."
It was a great story, all right, and Joseph drank on it for the next 7 years, until Peter was arrested for a hideous crime, judged guilty, and sentenced to imprisonment in the cell atop the needle for the rest of his life. XV. Perhaps you were wondering what Thomas was like, and some of you may already be casting him in the villain's part as a willing co-schemer in Flagg's plot to snatch the crown away from its rightful owner. That was not really the case at all, although to some it always seemed so, and of course Thomas did play a part. He did not seem, I admit, to be a really good boy. At least, not at first glance. He was surely not a good boy in the way that Peter was a good boy, but no brother would have looked really good beside Peter. And Thomas knew it well by the time he was 4. That was the year after the famous sack race, and the one in which the famous stable yard incident took place. Peter rarely lied and never cheated. Peter was smart and kind, tall and handsome. He looked like their mother, who had been so deeply loved by the king and the people of Delane. How could Thomas compare with goodness like that? A simple question with a simple answer. He couldn't. Unlike Peter, Thomas was the spitting image of his father. This pleased the old man a little, but it didn't give him the pleasure most men feel when they have a son who carries the clear stamp of their features. Looking at Thomas was too much like looking into a sly mirror. He knew that Thomas's fine blonde hair would gray early and then begin to fall out. Thomas would be bald by the time he was 40. He knew that Thomas would never be tall, and if he had his father's appetite for beer and mead, he would be carrying a big belly before him by the time he was 25. Already his toes had begun to turn in, and Roland guessed Thomas would walk with his own bow-legged swagger. Thomas was not exactly a good boy, but you must not think that made him a bad boy. He was sometimes a sad boy, often a confused boy. He took after his father in another way as well. Hard thinking made his nose stuffy and his head feel like boulders were rolling around inside, and often a jealous boy, but he wasn't a bad boy. Of whom was he jealous? Why, of his brother, of course. He was jealous of Peter. It wasn't enough that Peter would be king. Oh, no, it wasn't enough that their father liked Peter best, or that the servants liked Peter best, or that their teachers liked Peter best because he was always ready at lessons and didn't need to be coaxed. It wasn't enough that everyone liked Peter best, or that Peter had a best friend. There was one more thing. When anyone looked at Thomas, his father the king most of all, Thomas thought he knew they were thinking, "We loved your mother, and you killed her in your coming. And what did we get out of the pain and death you caused her? A dull little boy with a round face that has hardly any chin, a dull little boy who couldn't make all 15 of the great letters until he was 8. Your brother Peter was able to make them all when he was 6. What did we get? Not much. Why did you come, Thomas? What good are you? Throne insurance? Is that all you are? Throne insurance in case Peter the Precious should fall off his limping nag and crack his head open? Is that all? Well, we don't want you. None of us want you. None of us want you." The part Thomas played in his brother's imprisonment was dishonorable, but even so he was not a really bad boy. I believe this, and hope that in time you will come to believe it too. Once, as a boy of 7, Thomas spent a whole day laboring in his room, carving his father a model sailboat. He did it with no way of knowing that Peter had covered himself with glory that day on the archery range, with his father in attendance. Peter was not, ordinarily, much of a bowman. In that area, at least, Thomas would turn out to be far superior to his older brother. But on that one day, Peter had shot the junior course of targets like one inspired. Thomas was a sad boy, a confused boy, and he was often an unlucky boy. Thomas had thought of the boat because sometimes, on Sunday afternoons, his father liked to go out to the moat which surrounded the palace and float a variety of model boats. Such simple pleasures made Roland extremely happy, and Thomas had never forgotten one day when his father had taken him, and just him, along. In those days, his father had an advisor whose only job was to show Roland how to make paper boats, and the king had conceived a great enthusiasm for them. On this day, a hoary old carp had risen out of the mucky water and swallowed one of Roland's paper boats whole. Roland had laughed like a boy and declared it was better than a tale about a sea monster. He hugged Thomas very tight as he said so. Thomas never forgot that day. The bright sunshine, the damp, slightly moldy odor of the moat water, the warmth of his father's arms, the scratchiness of his beard. So, feeling particularly lonely one day, he had hit on the idea of making his father a sailboat. It would not be a really great job, and Thomas knew it. He was almost as clumsy with his hands as he was at memorizing his lessons. But he also knew that his father could have any craftsman in Delane, even the great Ellender himself, who was now almost completely blind, make him boats if he so desired. The crucial difference, Thomas thought, would be that Roland's own son had taken a whole day to carve him a boat for his Sunday pleasure. Thomas sat patiently by his window, urging the boat out of a block of wood. He used a sharp knife, nicked himself times without number, and cut himself quite badly once. Yet he kept on, aching hands or no. As he worked, he daydreamed of how he and his father would go out on Sunday afternoon and sail the boat, just the two of them, all alone, because Peter would be riding Peony in the woods or off playing with Ben. And he wouldn't even mind if that same carp came up and ate his wooden boat, because then his father would laugh and hug him and say it was better than a story of sea monsters eating Anduin clipper ships whole. But when he got to the king's chamber, Peter was there, and Thomas had to wait for nearly half an hour with the boat hidden behind his back while his father extolled Peter's bowmanship. Thomas could see that Peter was uncomfortable under the unceasing barrage of praise. He could also see that Peter knew Thomas wanted to talk to their father, and that Peter kept trying to tell their father so. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Thomas hated him anyway. At last Peter was allowed to escape. Thomas approached his father, who looked at him kindly enough now that Peter was gone. "I made you something, Dad," he said, suddenly shy. He held the boat behind his back with hands that were suddenly wet and clammy with sweat.
"Did you now, Tommy?"
Roland said.
"Why, that was kind, wasn't it?"
"Very kind, sire,"
said Flag, who happened to be idling nearby. He spoke casually, but watched Thomas with bright interest.
"What is it, lad? Show me."
"I remembered how much you like to have a boat or two out on the moat Sunday afternoons, Dad, and—"
He wanted desperately to say, "and I wanted you to take me out with you again sometime, so I made this," but he found he could not utter such a thing.
"And so I made you a boat. I spent a whole day, cut myself, and—"
Sitting in his window seat, carving the boat, Thomas had made up a long, eloquent speech which he would utter before bringing the boat out from behind his back and presenting it with a flourish to his father, but now he could hardly remember a word of it, and what he could remember didn't seem to make any sense. Horribly tongue-tied, he took the sailboat with its awkward flapping sail out from behind his back and gave it to Roland. The king turned it over in his big, short-fingered hands. Thomas stood and watched him, totally unaware that he had forgotten to breathe. At last Roland looked up.
Very nice, Tommy. Canoe, isn't it?
Sailboat.
Don't you see the sail?" he wanted to cry. "It took me an hour alone just to tie the knots, and it isn't my fault one of them came loose so it flaps." The king fingered the striped sail, which Thomas had cut from a pillowcase.
"So it is. Of course it is. At first I thought it was a canoe, and this was some Oranian girl's wash."
He tipped a wink at Flag, who smiled vaguely at the air and said nothing. Thomas suddenly felt he might vomit quite soon. Roland looked at his son more seriously and beckoned for him to come close. Timidly, hoping for the best, Thomas did so.
"It's a good boat, Tommy. Sturdy, like yourself. A bit clumsy, like yourself, but good, like yourself. And if you want to give me a really fine present, work hard in your bowmanship classes so you can take a first-class medal as Pete did today."
Thomas had taken a first in the lower circle bowmanship courses the year before, but his father seemed to have forgotten this in his joy over Peter's accomplishment. Thomas did not remind him. He merely stood there, looking at the boat in his father's big hands. His cheeks and forehead had flushed to the color of old brick.
"When it was at last down to just two boys, Peter and Lord Towson's son, the instructor decreed they should draw back another 40 kroner. Towson's boy looked downcast, but Peter just walked to the mark and knocked an arrow. I saw the look in his eyes, and I said to myself, 'He's won. By all the gods that are, he hasn't even fired an arrow yet, and he's won.' And so he had. I tell you, Tommy, you should have been there. You should have—"
the king prattled on, putting aside the boat Thomas had labored a whole day to make, with barely a second look. Thomas stood and listened, smiling mechanically, that dull, brick-like flush never leaving his face. His father would never bother to take the sailboat he had carved out to the moat. Why should he? The sailboat was as puky as Thomas felt. Peter could probably carve a better one blindfolded and in half the time. It would look better to their father, at least. A miserable eternity later, Thomas was allowed to escape.
I believe the boy worked very hard on that boat,
Flagg remarked carelessly.
Yes, I suppose he did, Roland said. Wretched-looking thing, isn't it? It looks a little like a dog turd with a handkerchief sticking out of it.
And like something I would have made when I was his age, he added in his own mind. Thomas could not hear thoughts, but a hellish trick of acoustics brought Roland's words to him just as he left the great hall. Suddenly the horrible green pressure in his stomach was 1,000 times worse. He ran to his bedroom and was sick in a basin. The next day, while idling behind the outer kitchens, Thomas spied a half-crippled old dog foraging for garbage. He seized a rock and threw it. The stone flew to the mark. The dog yipped and fell down, badly hurt. Thomas knew his brother, although 5 years older, could not have made such a shot at half the distance, but that was a cold satisfaction because he also knew that Pete never would have thrown a rock at a poor, hungry dog in the first place, especially one as old and decrepit as this one obviously was. For a moment, compassion filled Thomas's heart and his eyes filled with tears. Then, for no reason at all, he thought of his father saying, "Looks a little like a dog turd with a handkerchief sticking out of it." He gathered up a handful of rocks and went over to where the dog lay on its side, dazed and bleeding from one ear. Part of him wanted to let the dog alone, or perhaps heal it as Peter had healed Peony, to make it his very own dog and love it forever. But part of him wanted to hurt it, as if hurting the dog would ease some of his own hurt. He stood above it, undecided, and then a terrible thought came to him. Suppose that dog was Peter. That decided the case. Thomas stood over the old dog and threw stones at it until it was dead. No one saw him, but if someone had, he or she would have thought, "There is a boy who is bad. Bad, and perhaps even evil." But the person who saw only the cruel murder of that dog would not have seen what happened the day before, would not have seen Thomas throwing up into a basin and crying bitterly as he did it. He was often a confused boy, often a sadly unlucky boy. But I stick to what I said. He was never a bad boy. Not really. I also said that no one saw the stoning of the mongrel dog behind the outer kitchens, but that was not quite true. Flagg saw it that night in his magic crystal. He saw it, and was well pleased by it. XVII. Roland, Sasha, Peter, Thomas. Now there is only one more we must speak of, isn't there? Now there is only the shadowy fifth. The time has come to speak of Flagg, as dreadful as that may be. Sometimes the people of Delane called him Flagg the Hooded, sometimes simply the Dark Man, for in spite of his white, corpse's face, he was a dark man indeed. They called him well-preserved, but they used the term in a way that was uneasy rather than complimentary. He had come to Delane from Garlan in the time of Roland's grandfather. In those days he had appeared to be a thin and stern-faced man of about 40. Now, in the closing years of Roland's reign, he appeared to be a thin and stern-faced man of about 50. Yet it had not been 10 years or even 20 between then and now. It had been 76 years in all. Babies who had been sucking toothlessly at their mother's breasts when Flagg first came to Delane had grown up, married, had children, grown old, and died toothlessly in their beds or their chimney corners. But in all that time, Flagg seemed to have aged only 10 years. It was magic, they whispered. And of course, it was good to have a magician at court. a real magician and not just a stage conjurer who knew how to palm coins or hide a sleeping dove up his sleeve. Yet in their hearts, they knew there was nothing good about Flagg. When the people of Delane saw him coming, with his eyes peeking redly out from his hood, they quickly found business on the far side of the street. Did he really come from Garland with its far vistas and its purple dreaming mountains? I do not know. It was and is a magical land where carpets sometimes fly, and where holy men sometimes pipe ropes up from wicker baskets, climb them and disappear at the tops, never to be seen again. A great many seekers of knowledge from more civilized lands like Delane and Andua have gone to Garland. Most disappear as completely and as permanently as those strange mystics who climb the floating ropes. Those who do return don't always come back changed for the better. Yes, Flagg might well have come to Delane from Garland, but if he did, it was not in the reign of Roland's grandfather, but much, much earlier. He had, in fact, come to Delane often. He came under a different name each time, but always with the same load of woe and misery and death. This time he was Flagg. The time before he had been known as Bill Hinch, and he had been the king's Lord High Executioner. Although that time was 250 years past, he was a name mothers still used to frighten their children when they were bad. "If you don't shut up that squalling, I reckon Bill Hinch will come and take you away," they said. Serving as Lord High Executioner under 3 of the bloodiest kings in Delane's long history, Bill Hinch had made an end to hundreds, thousands, some said, of prisoners with his heavy axe. The time before that, 400 years before the time of Roland and his sons, he came as a singer named Browson, who became a close adviser to the king and a queen. Browson disappeared like smoke after drumming up a great and bloody war between Delane and Andua. The time before that... Ah, but why go on? I'm not sure I could if I wanted to. When times are long enough, even the storytellers forget the tales. Flagg always showed up with a different face and a different bag of tricks, but 2 things about him were always the same. He always came hooded, a man who seemed almost to have no face, and he never came as a king himself, but always as the whisperer in the shadows, the man who poured poison into the porches of kings' ears. Who was he, really? This dark man. I do not know. Where did he wander between visits to Delane? I do not know that either. Was he never suspected? Yes. By a few. By historians and spinners of tales like me, mostly. They suspected that the man who now called himself Flagg had been in Delane before, and never to any good purpose. But they were afraid to speak. A man who could live among them for 76 years and appear to age only 10 was obviously a magician. A man who had lived for 10 times as long, perhaps longer than that, such a man might be the devil himself. What did he want? That question I think I can answer. He wanted what evil men always want, to have power and use that power to make mischief. Being a king did not interest him because the heads of kings all too often found their way to spikes on castle walls when things went wrong. But the advisers to kings, the spinners in the shadows, such people usually melted away like evening shadows at dawning as soon as the headsman's axe started to fall. Flagg was a sickness, a fever looking for a cool brow to heat up. He hooded his actions just as he hooded his face. And when the great trouble came, as it always did after a span of years, Flagg always disappeared like shadows at dawn. Later, when the carnage was over and the fever had passed, when the rebuilding was complete and there was again something worth destroying, Flagg would appear once more. This time, Flagg had found the kingdom of Delane in exasperatingly healthy condition. Landry, Roland's grandfather, was a drunken old fool, easy to influence and twist, but a heart attack had taken him too soon. Flagg knew by then that Lita, Roland's mother, was the last person he wanted holding the scepter. She was ugly, but good-hearted and strong-willed. Such a queen was not a good growth medium for Flagg's brand of insanity. If he had come earlier in Landry's reign, there would have been time to put Leta out of the way, as he expected to put Peter out of the way, but he'd had only 6 years, and that was not long enough. Still, she had accepted him as an adviser, and that was something. She did not like him much, but she accepted him, mostly because he could tell wonderful fortunes with cards. Leta loved hearing bits of gossip and scandal about those in her court and her cabinet, and the gossip and scandal were doubly good because she got to hear not only what had happened, but what would happen. It was hard to rid yourself of such an amusing diversion, even when you sensed that a person able to do such tricks might be dangerous. Flagg never told the Queen any of the darker news he sometimes saw on the cards. She wanted to know who had taken a lover, or who had had words with his wife or her husband. She did not want to know about dark cabals and murderous plans. What she wanted from the cards was relatively innocent. During the long, long reign of Leta, Flagg was chagrined to find his main accomplishment was to be not turned out. He was able to maintain a foothold, but to do little more than that. Oh, there were a few bright spots. The encouragement of bad blood between two powerful squires in the southern barony, and the discrediting of a doctor who had found a cure for some blood infections. Flagg wanted no cures in the kingdom that were not magical, which is to say, given or withheld at his own whim, were examples of Flagg's work during that period. It was all pretty small change. Under Roland, poor, bow-legged, insecure Roland, things marched more quickly toward Flagg's goal, because he did have a goal, you know, in his fuzzy, malevolent sort of way, and this time it was grand indeed. He planned nothing more nor less than the complete overthrow of the monarchy, a bloody revolt that would plunge Delane into 1,000 years of darkness and anarchy, give or take a year or two, of course. 19. In Peter's cool gaze, he saw the very possible derailment of all his plans and careful work. More and more, Flagg came to believe that getting rid of Peter was a necessity. Flagg had overstayed in Delane this time, and he knew it. The muttering had begun. The work so well begun under Roland, the steady rises in taxes, the midnight searches of small farmers' barns and silage sheds for unreported crops and foodstuffs, the arming of the home guards, must continue to its end under Thomas. He did not have time to wait through the reign of Peter as he had through that of his grandmother. Peter might not even wait for the mutterings of the people to come to his ears. Peter's first command as king might well be that Flagg should be sent eastward out of the kingdom, and forbidden ever to come again on pain of death. Flagg might murder an adviser before he could give the young king such advice, but the hell of it was, Peter would need no adviser. He would advise himself. And when Flagg saw the cool, unafraid way the boy, now 15 and very tall, looked at him, he thought that Peter might already have given himself that advice. The boy liked to read, and he liked history, and in the last 2 years, as his father grew steadily grayer and frailer, he had been asking a lot of questions of his father's other advisers and some of his teachers. Many of these questions, too many, had to do either with Flagg or with roads which would lead to Flagg if followed far enough. That the boy was asking such questions at 14 and 15 was bad. That he was getting comparatively honest answers from such timid, watchful men as the kingdom's historians and Roland's advisers was much worse. It meant that, in the minds of these people, Peter was already almost king, and that they were glad. They welcomed him and rejoiced in him because he would be an intellectual like them. And they also welcomed him because, unlike them, he was a brave boy who might well grow into a lion-hearted king, whose tale would be the stuff of legends. In him, they saw again the coming of the White, that ancient, resilient, yet humble force that has redeemed humankind again and again and again. He had to be put out of the way, had to be. Flagg told himself this each night when he retired in the blackness of his inner chambers, and it was his first thought when he awoke in that blackness the next morning. He must be put out of the way. The boy must be put out of the way. But it was harder than it seemed. Roland loved and would have died for either of his sons, but he loved Peter with a particular fierceness, smothering the boy in his cradle, making it look as if the baby death had taken him would have once perhaps been possible, but Peter was now a healthy teenager. Any accident would be examined with all the raging scrutiny of Roland's grief, and Flagg had thought more than once that the final irony might be this. Suppose Peter really did die an accidental death, and he, Flagg, was somehow blamed for it. A small miscalculation while shinnying up a drainpipe. A slip while crawling around on a stable roof playing Dare You with his friend, Stodd. A tumble from his horse. And what would the result be? Might not Roland, wild in his grief and growing senile and confused in his mind, see willful murder in what was really an accident? And might his eye not turn on Flagg? Of course, his eye would turn to Flagg before it turned to anyone else. Roland's mother had mistrusted him, and he knew that deep down Roland mistrusted him as well. He had been able to hold that mistrust in check with mingled fear and fascination, but Flagg knew that if Roland ever had reason to think Flagg had caused or even played a part in the death of his son. Flagg could actually imagine situations where he might have to interfere in Peter's behalf to keep the boy safe. It was damnable, damnable! He must be put out of the way, must be put out of the way, must! As the days and weeks and months passed, the drumbeat of this thought in Flagg's head grew ever more urgent. Every day Roland grew older and weaker. Every day Peter grew older and wiser, and thus a more dangerous opponent. What was to be done? Flagg's thoughts turned and turned and turned on this. He grew morose and irritable. Servants, especially Peter's butler, Brandon, and Brandon's son, Dennis, gave him a wide berth and spoke to each other in whispers of the terrible smells that sometimes came from his laboratory late at night. Dennis, in particular, who would some day take the place of his good old Da, as Peter's butler, was terrified of Flagg, and once asked his father if he might say a word about the magician. "To make him safe is all I'm thinking," Dennis said. "Not a word," Brandon said, and fixed Dennis, who was only a boy himself, with a forbidding look. "Not a word will you say. The man's dangerous."
"Then is that not all the more reason?"
Dennis began timidly.
A dullard may mistake the rattle of a biter snake for the sound of pebbles in a hollow gourd and put out his hand to touch it, Brandon said. But our prince is no dullard, Dennis. Now fetch me another glass of bundle, Jen, and say no more on it.
So Dennis did not speak of it to Peter, but his love of his young master and his fear of the king's hooded adviser both grew after that short exchange. Whenever he saw Flagg sweeping up one of the corridors of the castle in his long, hooded robe, he would draw aside, trembling, thinking, "Biter snake! Biter snake! Watch for him, Peter, and listen for him!" Then, one night, when Peter was 16, just as Flagg had begun to believe that there really might not be any way to put an end to the boy without unacceptable risk to himself, an answer came. That was a wild night. A terrible autumn storm raged and shrieked around the castle, and the streets of Delane were empty as people sought shelter from the sheets of chilly rain and the battering wind. Roland had taken a cold in the damp. He took cold more and more easily these days, and Flagg's medicines, potent as they were losing their power to cure him. One of these colds, perhaps even the one he was hacking and wheezing with now, would eventually deepen into the wet lung disease, and that would kill him. Magic medicines were not like doctor's medicines, and Flagg knew that one of the reasons the potions he gave the old king were now so slow to work was that he, Flagg, no longer really wanted them to work. The only reason he was keeping Roland alive was that he feared Peter. "I wish you were dead, old man," Flagg thought with childish anger as he sat before a guttering candle, listening to the wind shriek without and his two-headed parrot mutter sleepily to itself within. "For a row of pins, a very short row at that, I'd kill you myself for all the trouble you and your stupid wife and your elder son have caused me. The joy of killing you would almost be worth the ruin of my plans. The joy of killing you." Suddenly he froze, sitting upright, staring off into the darkness of his underground rooms, where the shadows moved uneasily. His eyes glittered silver. An idea blazed in his mind like a torch. The candle flared a brilliant green and then went out. One of the parrot's two heads shrieked in the darkness.
"Murder!"
shrieked the other. And in that blackness, unseen by anyone, Flagg began to laugh. 20. Of all the weapons ever used to commit regicide, the murder of a king, none has been as frequently used as poison, and no one has greater knowledge of poisons than a magician. Flagg, one of the greatest magicians who ever lived, knew all the poisons that we know. Arsenic, strychnine, the curare, which steals inward, paralyzing all the muscles and the heart last, nicotine, belladonna, nightshade, toadstool. He knew the poison venoms of 100 snakes and spiders, the clear distillation of the Clanna lily, which smells like honey, but kills its victims in screaming torments, deadly clawfoot, which grows in the deepest shadows of the dismal swamp. Flagg did not know just dozens of poisons, but dozens of dozens, each worse than the last. They were all neatly ranked on the shelves of an inner room where no servant ever went. They were in beakers, in vials, in little envelopes. Each deadly item was neatly marked. This was Flagg's chapel of screams in waiting, agony's antechamber, foyer of fevers, dressing room for death. Flagg visited it often when he felt out of sorts and wanted to cheer himself up. In this devil's marketplace waited all those things that humans, who are made of flesh and are so weak, dread. Hammering headaches, screaming stomach cramps, detonations of diarrhea, vomiting, collapsing blood vessels, paralysis of the heart, exploding eyeballs, swelling, blackening tongues. Madness. But the worst poison of all Flagg kept separate from even these. In his study there was a desk. Every drawer of this desk was locked, but one was triple-locked. In it was a teak box carved all over with magical symbols, runes and such. The lock on this box was unique. Its plate seemed to be a dull orange steel, but very close inspection showed it was really some sort of vegetable matter. It was, in fact, a cleffa carrot, and once a week Flagg watered this living lock with a tiny spray bottle. The cleffa carrot also seemed to have some dull species of intelligence. If anyone tried to jimmy the cleffa lock open, or even if the wrong someone tried to use the right key, the lock would scream. Inside this box was a smaller box, which opened with a key Flagg wore always around his neck. Inside this second box was a packet. Inside the packet was a small quantity of green sand. Pretty, you would have said, but nothing spectacular. Nothing to write home to Mother about. Yet this green sand was one of the deadliest poisons in all the worlds, so deadly that even Flagg was afraid of it. It came from the desert of Gren. This huge poisoned waste lay even beyond Garlan, and was a land unknown in Delane. Gren could be approached only on a day when the wind was blowing the other way, because a single breath of the fumes which came from the desert of Gren would cause death. Not instant death. That was not the way the poison worked. For a day or two, perhaps even three, the person who breathed the poison fumes, or even worse, swallowed the grains of sand, would feel fine, perhaps better than ever before in his life. Then suddenly his lungs would grow red-hot. His skin would begin to smoke, and his body would shrivel like the body of a mummy. Then he would drop dead, often with his hair on fire. Someone who breathed or swallowed this deadly stuff would burn from the inside out. This was dragon sand, and there was no antidote, no cure. What fun! On that wild, rainy night, Flagg determined to give a bit of dragon sand to Roland and a glass of wine. It had become Peter's custom to take his father a glass of wine each night shortly before Roland turned in. Everyone in the palace knew it and commented on what a loyal son Peter was. Roland enjoyed his son's company as much as the wine he brought, Flagg thought, but a certain maiden had caught Peter's eye, and he rarely stayed longer than half an hour with his father these days. If Flagg came one night after Peter had left, Flagg did not think the old man would turn down a second glass of wine. A very special glass of wine. A hot vintage, my lord, Flagg thought, a grin dawning on his narrow face. A hot vintage indeed, and why not? The vineyard was right next door to hell, I think, and when this stuff starts working in your guts, you'll think hell is where you are. Flagg threw back his head and began to laugh. Once his plan was laid, a plan that would rid him of both Roland and Peter forever, Flagg wasted no time. He first used all his wizardry to make the king well again. He was delighted to find that his magic potions worked better than they had for a long, long time. It was another irony. He earnestly wanted to make Roland better so the potions worked, but he wanted to make the king better so he could kill him and make sure everyone knew it was murder. It was really quite funny when you stopped to think it over. On a windy night, less than a week after the king's hacking cough had ceased, Flagg unlocked his desk and took out the teak box. He murmured,
"Well done,"
to the Cleffa Carrot, which squeaked mindlessly in reply, and then lifted the heavy lid and took out the smaller box inside. He used the key around his neck to open it and took out the packet that contained the dragon sand. He had bewitched this packet, and it was immune to the dragon sand's terrible power. Or so he thought. Flagg took no chances and removed the packet with a small pair of silver tweezers. He laid it beside one of the king's goblets on his desk. Sweat stood out on his forehead in great round drops, for this was ticklish work indeed. One little mistake and he would pay for it with his life. Flagg went out into the corridor that led to the dungeons and began to pant. He was hyperventilating. When you breathe rapidly, you fill your whole body with oxygen and you can hold your breath for a long time. During the critical stage of his preparations, Flagg did not mean to breathe at all. But there would be no mistakes, big or little. He was having too much fun to die. He took a final great gasp of clean air from the barred window just outside the door to his apartment and re-entered his rooms. He went to the envelope, took his dagger from his belt, and delicately slit it open. There was a flat piece of obsidian, which the magician used as a paperweight on his desk. In those days, obsidian was the hardest rock known. Using the tweezers again, he grasped the packet, turned it upside down, and poured out most of the green sand. He saved back a tiny bit, hardly more than a dozen grains, but this bit of extra was extremely important to his plans. Hard as the obsidian was, the rock immediately began to smoke. 30 seconds had passed now. He picked up the obsidian, careful that not a single grain of dragon sand should touch his skin. If it did, it would work inward until it reached his heart and set it on fire. He tilted the stone over the goblet and poured it in. Now quickly, before the sand could begin to eat into the glass, he poured in some of the king's favorite wine, the same sort of wine Peter would be taking his father about now. The sand dissolved immediately. For a moment the red wine glimmered a sinister green, and then it returned to its usual color. 50 seconds. Flagg went back to his desk. He picked up the flat rock and took his dagger by its handle. Only a few grains of dragon sand had touched the blade when he slit through the paper, but already they were working their way in, and evil little streamers of smoke rose from the pox in the Anduin steel. He carried both the stone and the dagger out into the hallway. 70 seconds, and his chest was beginning to cry for air. 30 feet down the hallway, which led to the dungeon if you followed it far enough, a trip no one in Delane wanted to make, there was a grating in the floor. Flagg could hear gurgling water, and if he had not been holding his breath, he would have smelled a foul stench. This was one of the castle's sewers. He dropped both the rock and the blade into it and grinned at the double splash in spite of his pounding chest. Then he hurried back to the window, leaned far out, and took breath after gasping breath. When he had his wind back, he returned to his study. Now only the tweezers, the packet, and the glass of wine stood on the desk. There was not so much as a grain of sand on the tweezers, and the bit of sand left inside the bewitched packet could not harm him as long as he took reasonable care. He felt he had done very well indeed so far. His work was by no means done, but it was well begun. He bent over the goblet and inhaled deeply. There was no danger now. When the sand was mixed with a liquid, its fumes became harmless and undetectable. Dragon sand made deadly vapors only when it touched a solid, such as stone, such as flesh. Flagg held the goblet up to the light, admiring its bloody glow.
"A final glass of wine, my king,"
he said, and laughed until the two-headed parrot screamed in fear.
"Something to warm your guts."
He sat down, turned over his hourglass, and began to read from a huge book of spells. Flagg had been reading from this book, which was bound in human skin, for 1,000 years and had gotten through only a quarter of it. To read too long of this book, written on the high, distant plains of Leng by a madman named Al-Hazred, was to risk madness. An hour. Just an hour. When the top half of his hourglass was empty, he could be sure Peter would have come and gone. An hour, and he could take Roland this final glass of wine. For a moment, Flagg looked at the bone-white sand slipping smoothly through the waist of the hourglass, and then he bent calmly over his book. XXII. Roland was pleased and touched that Flagg should have brought him a glass of wine that night before he went to bed. He drank it off in two large gulps and declared that it had warmed him greatly. Smiling inside his hood, Flagg said,
"I thought it would, Your Highness."
XXIII. Whether it was fate or only luck that caused Thomas to see Flagg with his father that night is another question you must answer for yourself. I only know that he did see, and that it happened in large part because Flagg had been at pains over the years to make a special friend of this friendless, miserable boy. I'll explain in a moment, but first I must correct a wrong idea you may have about magic. In stories of wizardry, there are three kinds that are usually spoken of almost carelessly, as if any second-class wizard could do them. These are turning lead into gold, changing one's shape, and making oneself invisible. The first thing you should know is that real magic is never easy, and if you think it is, just try making your least favorite aunt disappear the next time she comes to spend a week or two. Real magic is hard. And although it is easier to do evil magic than good, even bad magic is tolerably hard. Turning lead into gold can be done, once you know the names to call on, and if you can find someone to show you exactly the right trick of splitting the loaves of lead. Shape-changing and invisibility, however, are impossible, or so close to it that you might as well use the word. From time to time, Flagg, who was a great eavesdropper, had listened to fools tell tales about young princes who escaped the clutches of evil genies by uttering a simple magic word and popping out of sight, or beautiful young princesses. In the stories they were always beautiful, although Flagg's experience had been that most princesses were spoiled rotten and, as the end products of long inbred family lines, ugly as sin and stupid in the bargain, who tricked great ogres into becoming flies, which they then quickly swatted. In most stories, the princesses were also good at swatting flies, although most of the princesses Flagg had seen wouldn't have been able to swat a fly dying on a cold windowsill in December. In stories, it all sounded easy. In stories, people changed their shapes or turned themselves into walking window panes all the time. In truth, Flagg had never seen either trick done. He had once known a great Anduin magician who believed he had mastered the trick of changing his shape. But after 6 months of meditation and nearly a week of incantations and a series of agonizing body postures, he uttered the last awesome spell and succeeded only in making his nose nearly 9 feet long and driving himself insane. And there had been fingernails growing out of his nose, Flagg remembered with a grim little smile. Great magician or not, the man had been a fool. Invisibility was likewise impossible, at least as far as Flagg himself had been able to determine. Yet it was possible to make oneself dim. Yes, dim. That was really the best word for it, although others sometimes came to mind. Ghostly, transparent, unobtrusive. Invisibility was out of his reach, but by first eating a pizzle and then reciting a number of spells, it was possible to become dim. When one was dim, and a servant approached along a passageway, one simply drew aside and stood still and let the servant pass. In most cases, the servant's eyes would drop to his own feet or suddenly find something interesting to look at on the ceiling. If one passed through a room, conversation would falter and people would look momentarily distressed, as if all were having gas pains at the same time. Torches and wall sconces grew smoky. Candles sometimes blew out. It was necessary to actually hide when one was dim, only if one saw someone whom one knew well. For whether one was dim or not, these people almost always saw. Dimness was useful, but it was not invisibility. On the night Flagg took the poisoned wine to Roland, he first made himself dim, He did not expect to see anyone he knew. It was after 9 o'clock now. The king was old and unwell. The days were short, and the castle went to bed early.
When Thomas is king,
Flagg thought, carrying the wine swiftly through the corridors,
there will be parties every night.
He already has his father's taste for drink, although he favors wine.